Chapter 2. In the afternoon, we are sitting around in a brewery yard. From the office of the factory comes our company commander, Lieutenant Hale, and calls us together. An order has come through that representatives are to be elected from the ranks. We are astounded. No one has ever heard of such a thing before. Then Max Vile appears in the courtyard, waving a newspaper and shouting, "There's revolution in Berlin!" Hale swings round.
"Rubbish," he says sharply.
"There are disturbances in Berlin."
But Vile has not done yet.
"The Kaisers fled to Holland."
That wakes us up. Vile must be mad, surely. Hale turns fiery red.
"Damned liar," he roars.
Vile hands him the paper. Hale screws it up and glares furiously at Vile. He cannot bear Vile, for Vile is a Jew, a quiet fellow who is always sitting about, reading. But Hale is a fire eater.
"All talk,"
he growls, and looks at Vile as if he would choke him. Max unbuttons his tunic and produces yet another special edition. Hale glances at it, tears it to bits, and goes back into his billet. Vile gathers up the shreds of his newspaper, pieces them together, and reads us the news. And we just sit there like a row of sodded hens. This is clean beyond our comprehension.
"It says he wanted to avoid a civil war," says Vile.
"What rot," snaps Cazola. "Supposing we had said that a while back, eh? Well, I'll be damned. So that's what we've been holding out here for."
"Yup," says Bethke, shaking his head.
"Just give me a dig in the ribs, will you, and see if I'm still here."
Yup establishes the fact.
"Then it must be so, no doubt," continues Bethke. "All the same, I don't quite catch on to the idea. Why, if one of us had done that, they would have stood him up against the wall."
"Best not to think of Wessling and Schroeder now," mutters Cazola, clenching his fists. "Else I'll run amok. Poor little Schroeder, a mere kid, and there he lay, all bashed to a jelly. And the man he died for just cuts and runs. Dirty scum!"
Suddenly he senses heels crashing against a beer cask. Willy Hohmeyer makes a gesture of dismissal.
"Let's talk about something else," he then suggests. "For my part, I've done with the fellow, absolutely."
Vile starts to explain how soldiers' councils have already been set up in a number of the regiments. The officers are not the leaders anymore. Many of them have even had their shoulder straps ripped off. He would have us set up a soldiers' council, too, but he does not get much encouragement. We don't want to set up anything anymore. We want to go home, and we can do that quite well as we are. In the end, we elect three representatives, Adolf Bethke, Vile, and Ludwig Breyer. Vile wants Ludwig to take down his shoulder straps.
"Here," says Ludwig wearily, lightly smoothing his forehead.
But Bethke shoves Vile back.
"Ludwig belongs to us," he says curtly.
Breyer came to our company as a volunteer and was afterwards given a commission. It is not only with Troske, Hohmeyer, Brügger, and me that he talks familiarly. That goes without saying, of course. We were former schoolfellows. But when no other officer is about, he is the same with all his old mates in the ranks, and his credit stands high in consequence.
"Well, hail then," insists Vile.
That is easier to understand. Vile has often been ridiculed by Hale, so what wonder then if he now means to savor his triumph? That, we feel, is no business of ours. Hale was rather harsh, it is true, but he did go for them. He was always up and coming where there was trouble, and a soldier gives credit for that.
Well, you can ask him, of course, says Bethke. But take a few bandages along with you, Tjaden calls after him.
The event takes another turn, however. Hale issues from the office just as Vile is about to enter. He has some message forms in his hand. He points to them.
You're right, he says to Max.
Vile begins to speak. When he comes to the question of the shoulder straps, Hale makes a swift movement. For an instant, we imagine there is going to be a stand-up fight, but to our astonishment, the company commander merely says abruptly,
Quite so.
Then, turning to Ludwig, he lays a hand on his shoulder.
You don't understand, perhaps, Briar. A private's tunic, that's the idea. The other is finished with now.
No one utters a word. This is not the Hale that we know, the man who would go on patrol at night armed with nothing but a walking stick, whom everyone regarded as bulletproof. This man is hard put to it just to stand up and speak. This evening, as I lay already asleep, I was roused by sounds of whispering.
You're pulling my leg, I hear Kozola say. Fact, persists Villy. You come and see.
They get up hastily and go out into the yard. I follow them. There is a light in the office so that it is possible to see inside. Hale is seated at the table. His blue officer's jacket, the Litevka, is lying before him. The shoulder straps have gone. He is wearing a private's tunic. His head is in his hands, and... But no, that cannot be. I go a step nearer. Hale. Hale is crying.
Can you beat it? Whispers Tjaden.
Hop it, says Bethke, and gives Tjaden a kick.
We sneak off, embarrassed. Next morning, we hear that a major in one of the neighboring regiments shot himself when he learned of the flight of the Emperor. Hale is coming. He is gray and worn with sleeplessness. Quietly, he gives the necessary instructions. Then he goes again. And we all feel just terrible. The last thing that was left to us has been taken away. The very ground cut from under our feet.
We're betrayed. Well and truly betrayed. That's what we are, says Kozola grumpily.
Very different from yesterday is the column that lines up today and marches dismally off. A lost company, an abandoned army. The entrenching tool claps with every stop. Monotonous melody. In vain. In vain. Lederhose alone is as happy as a lark. He sells us tinned meat and sugar out of his American plunder. Next evening, we reach Germany. Now that French is no longer spoken everywhere around us, we begin at last to believe that the peace is real. Until now, we have been secretly expecting an order to turn about and go back to the trenches. A soldier is mistrustful of good, and it is better to expect the contrary from the outset. But now, a bubbling ferment begins slowly to work in us. We enter a large village. A few bedraggled garlands hang across the street. So many troops have passed through already that it is not worthwhile to make any special fuss about the last of them. So we must content ourselves with the faded welcome of a few rain-sodden placards loosely looped around with oak leaves cut out of green paper. The people hardly so much as look at us as we march by. So accustomed have they grown to soldiers returning. But for us, it is a new thing to come here, and we hunger for a few friendly looks, however much we may pretend we do not give a damn. The girls, at least, might stop and wave to us. Every now and then, Tjaden and Jupp try to attract the attention of one, but without success. We look too grisly, no doubt. So in the end, they give it up. Only the children accompany us. We take them by the hand, and they run along beside us. We give them all the chocolate we can spare. We want, of course, to take some small part of it home. Adolf Bethke has taken a little girl up in his arms. She tugs at his beard as if it were a bridle and laughs with glee to see his grimaces. The little hands pat his face. He catches hold of one of them to show me how tiny it is. The child begins to cry now that he is pulling no more faces. Adolf tries to pacify her, but she only cries the more loudly, and he has to put her down.
"We seem to have turned into first-rate boogeymen," growls Cazola.
"Who wouldn't be scared of such a prize frontline fizz?" Villy explains to him. "It must just give them the creeps."
"We smell of blood. That's what it is," says Ludwig Breyer wearily.
"Well, we must have a jolly good bath," replies Jupp. "And perhaps that will make the girls a bit keener, too."
"Yes, if bathing were all there is to it," answers Ludwig pensively.
Listlessly, we trudge onward. We had pictured our entry into our own country after the long years out there rather differently from this. We imagined that people would be waiting for us, expecting us. Now we see that already everyone is taken up with his own affairs. Life has moved on, is still moving on. It is leaving us behind almost as if we were superfluous already. This village, of course, is not Germany. All the same, the disappointment sticks in our gizzard, and a shadow passes over us, and a queer foreboding. Carts rattle past, drivers shout, men look up as they pass, then fall again to their own thoughts and cares. The hour is pealing from the church tower. The damp wind sniffs us as it goes by. Only an old woman with long bonnet strings is running indefatigably along the column, and in a tremulous voice is asking for a certain Erhard Schmidt. We are billeted in a large outhouse. Though we have marched a long way, no one wants to rest. We go off to the inn. Here is life in plenty, and a turbid wine of this year's vintage. It tastes wonderful, and it works powerfully in the legs, so we are the more content to sit. Clouds of tobacco smoke drift through the low room. The wine smells of the earth and of summer. We fetch out our tins of preserved meat, carve off great slices, and lay them on thick slabs of buttered bread, stick our knives upright beside us in the big wooden table, and eat. The oil lamp beams down upon us all like a mother. Night makes the world beautiful. Not in frontline trenches, of course, but in peace. This afternoon we marched in here dejected. Now we begin to revive. The little band playing in the corner soon gets reinforcement from our fellows. We can supply not merely pianists and virtuosos with the mouth organ. There is even a Bavarian with a zither. Willy Hohmeyer will not be out of it. He has rigged himself up a sort of devil's fiddle, and with the aid of a couple of enormous pot lids is treating us to the combined glory and clash of cymbals, kettle drums, and rattles. But the unusual thing that goes to our heads even more than the wine is the girls. They are quite other than they seemed this afternoon. They smile and are complacent. Or are these different ones, perhaps? It is so long now since we have seen any girls. At first we are both eager and shy at the same time. We are not quite sure of ourselves. We seem to have forgotten how to get along with them. At last, Ferdinand Cozzola waltzes off with one, a husky wench with massive breastworks that should afford his gun a good lie. Now all the others are following his lead. The heavy, sweet wine sings pleasantly in the head. The girls are whirling by, and the music plays. We are sitting in a group in one corner, gathered about Adolf Bethke.
"Well, boys," says he, "tomorrow or next day we'll be home again. Yes, my wife. 10 months it is now."
I lean across the table and speak to Valentin Laher, who is looking the girls over coolly with a superior air. There is a blonde sitting beside him, but he is paying her little attention. As I lean forward, something in my tunic pocket presses against the edge of the table. I feel to find out what it is. Vessling's watch. Jupp has hooked the fattest dame. He is dancing like a question mark. His paw lies flat upon her ample buttocks, and there is playing the piano. With moist lips, she is smiling up into his face, and he is growing bolder every minute. Finally, he waltzes out through the door into the yard and vanishes. A few minutes later, I go out and make for the nearest corner. But already a perspiring sergeant is standing there with a lass. I trundle off into the garden, and am just about to begin when there is a terrific crash immediately behind me. I turn round to see Jupp with Fatty rolling on the ground. A garden table has given way beneath them. The fat lady guffaws when she sees me and puts out her tongue. Jupp hisses. I disappear hastily behind some bushes and tread on someone's hand. A hell of a night.
"Can't you walk, you clumsy cow?" asks a deep voice.
"How was I to know there was a worm there?" I retort peevishly, moving off to find a quiet corner at last. A cool wind, very good after the smoke inside there. Dark roofs and gables, boughs overhanging, stillness, and the peaceful plashing as I piddle. Albert comes and stands beside me. The moon is shining. We piss bright silver.
"Man, but it's good, eh, Ernst?" says Albert.
I nod. We gaze a while into the moon.
"To think the damned show is over, Albert, eh? My bloody oath."
There is creaking and crackling behind us. Girls laugh out clear among the bushes and are as suddenly hushed. The night is like a thunderstorm, heavy with fever of life, erupting, wildly and swiftly flashing from one point to another and kindling. Someone groans in the garden, an answering giggle. Shadows clamber down from the hayloft. Two are standing on a ladder. The man buries his head like a madman among the girl's skirts and stammers something. She laughs in a coarse, loud voice that scrapes over our nerves like a brush. Shudders purl down my back. How near they come together, yesterday and today. Death and life. Chadden comes up from the dark garden. He is suffused in sweat, and his face is glowing.
"Boy," says he, buttoning up his tunic, "now a man knows again what it is to be alive."
We take a turn around the house and discover Willy Hohmeyer. He has lit a great fire of weeds in a field and thrown on a few handfuls of scrounged potatoes. Now there he sits alone before it, peacefully dreaming, waiting till the potatoes are baked. Nearby are laid out a few tins of American cutlets, and the dog is squatting watchfully beside him. The flickering of the fire throws copper gleams through his red hair. Mists are gathering from the meadows. The stars twinkle. We sit down beside him and fish our potatoes from the fire. The skins are burned black, but the inside is golden yellow and fragrant. We grasp the cutlets in both hands and saw away at them as if they were mouth organs. And we wash them down with schnapps out of our aluminum cups. Potatoes! How good they taste! And where are we exactly? has the earth returned on her tracks? Are we children again, sitting in the field near Torloxton? Haven't we been digging potatoes all day in the strong-smelling earth? And behind us, with baskets, red-cheeked girls in faded blue dresses. And now the potato fire. White mists trailing over the field, the fire crackling, and the rest all still. The potatoes, they were the last fruit. Now all is gathered in. Now only the earth, the clean air, the loved, bitter white smoke, the end of the harvest. Bitter smoke, bitter smell of the harvest, potato fire of our childhood. Wraiths of mist drift up, draw together and withdraw. Faces of comrades. We are marching. The war is ended. All is melting, dissolving away. Potato fires have come to their own again, and the harvest and life.
Ah, Villy. Villy, my boy. This is the stuff, eh?
Says he, looking up, his hands full of meat and potatoes. Ah, fathead, I was meaning something far different. The fire has burned out. Villy wipes his hands on his breeches and shuts his knife with a snap. A few dogs are barking in the village. Otherwise, all is quiet. No more shells. No clatter of munition columns. No more the wary scrunching of ambulance cars. A night in which far fewer men will die than ever in the last 4 years. We go back into the inn, but there is not much doing now. Valentin has taken off his tunic and stands up on his hands a few times. The girls applaud, but Valentin is dissatisfied. I was a good artist once, Ferdinand, but that won't do, not even for the village fairs, he says gloomily to Cazola. Gone stiff in the joints, I have. Valentini's famous turn on the horizontal bar. That was a thing to gaze on, I can tell you. And now I've got rheumatics.
Ah, you be thankful you've got any bones left at all, says Cazola, and crashes his hand down on the table. Music! Villy!
Homeyer sets to work with a will on kettle drum and rattles. Things begin to be lively again. I ask Jupp how he got along with Fatty, but he dismisses her with a most scornful gesture. Come, come, I say in surprise. That's pretty sudden, isn't it? He makes a grimace. Yes, I thought she was gone on me, don't you know? And the fat bitch wanted money from me after. It was the shock made me bump my knee against that blasted garden table. I can hardly walk now. Ludwig Breyer is seated at the table, pale and still. He ought to have been asleep long ago, but he does not want to go. His arm is healing well, and the dysentery has improved slightly. But he remains turned in upon himself and troubled.
Ludwig, says Tjaden in a thick voice. You should go out into the garden for a bit, too. It heals all diseases.
Ludwig shakes his head and turns suddenly very pale. I sit down beside him. Aren't you glad to be going home? I ask him. He gets up and goes away. I cannot make him out. Later, I discover him outside, standing alone. I question him no more. We go inside again in silence. In the doorway, we bump into Lederhose, just making off with Fatty. Jupp grins in gleeful malice. There's a surprise in store for him. For her, corrects Villy. Or do you think Arthur may offer her a few pfennigs, perhaps? Wine is running over the table. The lamp is smoking, and the girls' skirts are flying. A warm, damp weariness drifts lightly at the back of my brow. Everything has soft, blurred edges, like star shells seen through fog. My head sinks slowly down upon the table. Then the night roars on, smoothly and wonderful, like an express train across the country. Soon we are at home.